As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The presenting sponsor for today's episode of Hear That Podcast Growlin' is Visa, a network working for everyone. All right, welcome to the latest edition of Hear That Podcast Growlin'. Paul Diener Jr. and Jay Morrison of The Athletic are here with you on coming off a Bengals victory on Sunday, and the Chicago Bears are in front of them on this Sunday in Chicago, first road trip of the year. Bengals and Steelers 1-0, Browns and Ravens 0-1. I mean, what else do you want?
I mean, I was surprised at Pittsburgh. If you'd have told me those other two results, I would have said the Bengals would have been in first place after week one. That one really surprised me. But yes, I'm happy. Chicago might be my favorite city to go to. I really enjoy it. It's a short drive. It's easy. There's just so much to do there. So I am looking forward to that, but that's down the road. We still have Minnesota to rehash.
We have some we're going to go into some big pick. We, you know, I hope everybody enjoyed the walkout, where we have a lot of our instant reactions. We've got some more big picture stuff and some reaction from the team and players, which was fairly interesting over the last couple of days. So we're going to dig a little bit into some of the news. We're going to talk about some of the things that Jesse Bates had to say yesterday. First time we've heard from him in a long time. First time he's been available since really this contract stuff popped up before the preseason. And he was not really necessarily holding back that he isn't super thrilled. In fact, the word pissed was used a number of times about where things ended up there. We'll kind of get into what happens and what went down with Jesse Bates, but also the defensive side of the fourth down aggressiveness equation that also is fairly interesting. And we've got a couple stories up today. Jay, you've got your final thoughts with a run through of a lot of interesting things, which has some important defensive takeaways in there. I have a story up on, I think, the most encouraging element of Sunday, and that was the play of the defensive line and the defensive tackles in particular, the waves of the four defensive tackles that came through and really changed the entire dynamic of this game and what that means as you look ahead the next few weeks to getting off to that very important fast start to the season. Some numbers that surprised me a little bit when we jumped into them, and but probably wouldn't surprise Kirk Cousins, who was real sick of Paul Brown Stadium by the time he left here on Sunday. We have a new segment for you every Tuesday. We're going to have Mo Egger from ESPN 1530 come on and join us for 10 minutes on the topic, and it's going to have a very long, hard name to pronounce because we don't like when people use things like playing off names, and I'm sure somebody who has heard 10 Mo minutes or some concept of that there of his entire career will appreciate that. But we're going to talk to Mo every week. Today we're going to talk to him about Ja'Marr Chase and that moment when the ball was in the air, both on the first catch and on the deep ball, and you know, what his feelings were on the debut of Ja'Marr Chase. We are going to talk a little bit about the running game and the fact that they ran it as much as they did, take some stock of the offensive line after a day when Joe Burrow had to limp off the field at one point and took a bunch of hits. So a lot to get to as we kind of transition from Minnesota to evil Andy Dalton and the Chicago Bears. I mean, the beard is just – the Andy Dalton beard is just – it's so pronounced. And I, as I pointed out when Dan Horde was tweeted that he couldn't get over the beard, that he is kind of like evil Andy Dalton, but even an evil version of Andy Dalton is still nicer than like 99% of the rest of us. but it, we will be preparing for that as the Bears game gets closer.
My dad always told me when I was growing up, a man with a beard has something to hide. And I don't think Andy Dalton has anything to hide. And it was ironic because my dad had a beard. So that's just one of those things, you know, those little sayings that your parents say when you're younger. That was one of the ones that always stuck out to me. And I always think of that. And I've never really been able to grow a beard. When quarantine started early in 2020, I tried and it took about 2 months to even make it look like a beard. And then I just got sick of the itchiness and got rid of it. And I don't know how Andy or any other player plays with a helmet on with that much facial hair.
Next week, Brett Kiesel shows up on that podcast ground as we dive deep into chin straps and beards and their lives. Let's talk about quick news. No Trey Waynes on Sunday. So I guess it sounds like we're going to see Eli Apple again, which I don't know how Bengals fans feel about that. We've reached the defending Eli Apple portion of the program for the Bengals coaching staff, who claimed they thought he played well, that there were no explosives against him. I would say giving up a 3rd and 24 because you can't tackle would probably qualify as an explosive, but who am I? And so, again, no, it doesn't sound like there's going to be snaps trending towards Darius Phillips chipping away at that. They sounded fairly happy with the way Eli Apple played as a whole. One play that kind of went under the radar against Eli Apple because of the total chaos of the moment was the throw that set up the game tying field goal. It was basically just Kirk Cousins being like, Adam Thielen versus Eli Apple, here we go, and just throwing it up to him one on one, and Apple not making the play. That was kind of their strategy all day. And it worked in that equation and also on the drive for the first touchdown.
Yeah, Eli Apple with the worst PFF grade among all Bengals defenders and wasn't even really close. I guess there's something to that this team has been burned over the top and had those explosive plays for so long that I guess it's you can kind of see where they would look at it that way and say there were no explosives, but you're right. To miss, not just miss a tackle, but miss a tackle on the sideline, where all you got to do is give the guy a shove to get him out of bounds. And then it wasn't just, that was the first of three. You know, then he has the defensive holding that gates a sack, and then he gets beat for the touchdown. 3 out of 4 plays, just a meltdown. We've said it many times. There is something that they really don't like about Darius Phillips, because the guy has earned it. And maybe it's just a trust factor if he can't do it over long stretches, but it is really curious. And I thought Darius looked great returning punts. I think he's leading the NFL in punt return yardage right now. It doesn't sound like he's going to get any run at cornerback.
We shall see. We'll keep an eye on those snap counts. But Phillips, I think, had 8 defensive snaps on Sunday against Minnesota. So Joe Burrow, who obviously had limped off, was kind of holding his shoulder a little bit, said he got rolled up on his ankle after the game. I asked Taylor about that on Monday, and he said he expects no limitations for him at practice this week. We'll keep an eye on that Wednesday practice report when the truth has to come out. But he may be limited, but it sounds like that would be a minor version of limited, or maybe he'd be full participant but listed with ankle or something like that. So we'll see how it actually plays out, but sounds like zero concern over Joe Burrow's health after kind of getting dinged a little bit in the game on Sunday. And then on the news side of things, we have Jesse Bates. And so Jesse Bates' contract did not get done by the deadline. So as far as where that stands, he didn't say specifically. He kind of said he basically wasn't going to go into details over whether there was still time for that to get done. But, I mean, we know what it has been and typically is around here. The season starts, that's the deadline. And he also multiple times said, see what next year brings, see what next year brings, talking about next offseason. So you can pretty much put two and two together. The deal didn't get done. And that means what will happen is you'll see them place the franchise tag on Jesse Bates next year. And then at that point, you get into this franchise tag situation where they have until basically mid-July to get a long-term contract done with Jesse. And if they don't, then he will have to play next year on the 1 year. It'll probably end up in the 13 range. That number hasn't come out yet. 1 year, about $13 million franchise tag deal that's baked in. And so, you know, you're not losing Jesse Bates. He's going to continue to play. But again, you have poked the bear of a team captain and leader. We have gone down this road a million times about him and what he means and what haggling with Jesse Bates and not being able to get this deal done means for you and your locker room that you love the good vibes of. And he wasn't super shy about it.
Yeah. You said you're not losing Jesse Bates, and that's true imminently, but I mean, what do you think if obviously just assume they don't get it done this season, because it is always the deadline of the opener. If they tag him next year, is that the final straw? Is there any chance that they sign a long-term deal after the tag? Or because, I mean, he's pissed off now.
What do you mean after the tag?
Well, after that season, after the 2022 season ends.
Oh, then well, they can tag him again.
True. But, I mean, players do not like being tagged, and Jesse's already mad. And this is a guy it would feel like you want to keep here long term. Is, you know, if they tag him next year, is it irreparable? I mean, I guess money speaks louder than everything. And if this team starts winning and he's got Joe Burrow and he sees a chance to win a championship here, that could change it too. But if this team doesn't kind of climb that mountain, are they playing with fire here and kind of burning a bridge where you're losing any chance to keep him once he is free to go wherever he wants to go?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, you see some things that look pretty ugly get done. And that's why it's kind of surprising this one didn't. I think that's because there was the ability to kick the can down the road. And Jesse seemed to have a little bit, even way back before the season started, a willingness to kick the can down the road on this one and play out this year and bet on himself a little bit. We'll see how that plays out. You know, I mean, they can get a deal done as soon as any time. You know, I mean, they can get a deal done before the franchise tag, or, you know, at any point they have an opportunity to sit down and say, let's just knock this out and let's take care of it. I think eventually if you get to a number that someone's asking for, and maybe he takes, you know, he felt like he did all the right stuff. Mm-hmm. I practiced. I was a good teammate. I got elected captain. I didn't go out there like Jamal Adams and sit out and force your hand a little bit. Maybe he doesn't feel that way next year. Maybe he feels like I tried that other method and that didn't work. Maybe I should try the method that worked for Jamal Adams when he got his big deal because he sat out and didn't participate in anything. You know, I tried to do it the right way, and what happened for me? Right? So I think that's the difference. That's what ends up happening if you don't. Now you're in a franchise tag situation, so who knows? But we saw how AJ Green enjoyed and handled, you know, the concept of the franchise tag. It's a distraction, man. It's a distraction, and it's insulting in a lot of ways. And I think that's what Jesse Bates feels. He sounded like a guy that felt a little insulted. So if you want to know what he sounded like, here's Jesse Bates talking about contract stuff really for the first time, except for that one little blip where he ended up on Bengals social media platforms discussing it.
Jesse, are you expecting contract negotiations? Basically, are they done now until the end of the season?
I'm not sure.
What's that like playing? You know, I'm sure you said this is something obviously you wanted to get done in the off season, or at least, you know, at the beginning of training camp. How does it affect you that it's not done? How do you approach that now, you know, towards the rest of the season as you approach 2022?
Yeah, I wish it would have got done, obviously. I mean, they got Sam Dunn. I was hoping to be the next guy up. But like I said, it is what it is. I'm going to play my part. I'm going to be a captain of this team. And next year, we'll see what happens.
So, I mean, you know, you tell me the tone of Jesse Bates. You tell me if he, I mean, he wasn't, if he was trying to hide how he truly felt, I don't think he was doing it very well, or else he just wasn't real concerned with it, which I would guess the latter.
Yeah, he's bitter, he's angry, but he's not sullen. He's not going to go out and pout and not play his best. He's going to do the exact opposite. He's going to go out there, like he said, pissed off and take it out on the other team, which is exactly what Bengals fans want to hear and maybe probably what the front office wants to see too. It started off great. I mean, he led the team in tackles Sunday, had one bad missed tackle. I almost thought it was Eli Apple. It was so bad because I saw the zero and I just assumed it was Eli Apple.
Had to be Eli Apple.
But he laid some wood on some hits too, and it just really played well. And if you're getting that Jesse Bates for 17 games, I think everybody in that organization is going to be happy.
All right, let's take a second and switch gears here and hear from a sponsor.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
You know, a lot of the conversation also after the game was about, look, the aggressiveness of Zach Taylor and going for it on fourth down. Jay, you have the story up after the game of going through all those decisions through the angle of analytics, through the angle of gut, through the angle of the message it sent and what people felt about it. And the one aspect of that was missing, because we didn't really get a chance to talk to anybody in that regard, was how the defense felt about being put up against a wall by the fourth down decision at your own 30. And then also on top of that, the cover zero call on fourth and four, which cover zero has been a forbidden word to say around here due to what happened against Pittsburgh back in 2018. And, you know, it was very similar in that regard, but they weren't thrilled with it, to the point that Jesse says nobody was happy about it. We were pissed off about the call, and Zach Taylor had to call everybody up on the sidelines and say, look, this is the team we're going to be this year. We're going to go for it and be aggressive in certain situations. We're going to call cover zeros. This is who we are. This is who we're going to be. And his point was, yeah, I don't think anybody was really thrilled about the call or that, but it is what it is. That's football. And, you know, again, a defense who's like, we're kicking their ass. Can you just let us continue kicking their ass and not put us in the spot where you give them a chance to have one play offset all of that? And I think that was kind of the feel from the defensive side of the ball, at least if you're reading the lines of what Jesse said.
Yeah, and I see where he's coming from. But I also, you know, I track these every year. I do these drive charts. And the Bengals were really good at, after they turned the ball over, of holding teams to field goals as opposed to letting them capitalize and get touchdowns. Now, when you start them at your 30, it's almost a guaranteed field goal. But I thought that was interesting too, that a lot of times a player would say, you know, it all worked out. It doesn't matter what I think. I'm not Joe Burrow would have said this. I'm not paid to make that decision. He did say that, as a matter of fact. But Jesse was blunt. He said, I was pissed off. A lot of us weren't happy with that call. I mean, maybe that's what you want from your defense. The call itself, you know, if you're the Patriots, if you're any team with a history of winning and stomping people, maybe you see that a little more, but you're a team trying to get over the hump. This opener is everything to you. It did seem a little too risky, even if the math says it's in your favor slightly. But yeah, it would have really been interesting to have an open locker room as opposed to, you know, just the limited access we get where they just bring in players that they choose. Because if we could have talked to a bunch of those defensive starters, I think we would have gotten a lot more answers like Jesse's about them being pissed off about that call.
That is pretty much the case with damn near every topic you have as a listener and as a reader, is that you are not getting the real story. It's impossible to get the real story. You only get the polished, and that's the polished version. You're right. I mean, you never get the real anymore because of the decisions that have been made on the league level and elsewhere to restrict any real access. But that's where we're at. So, but you're right. I mean, and it just leaves you in a situation where I don't think it, I mean, this wasn't Carlos Dunlap, right? I mean, this wasn't Carlos where every time he's in front of a microphone last year, he's just bashing someone, whether it's the front office, the team, the coaching staff or whatever. I mean, it was a win. Jesse's like, we were happy. Everyone was hungover. Maybe he was still a little hungover, and that's why he was talking the way he was. But I think there's still a pretty good vibe, and the win helps and all that stuff. And I think going into it knowing that this is what it's going to be is helpful too. Like, look, this is the aggressive type team we're going to be. You know, nobody takes shots at the Ravens for the fact that they do more cover zero than anybody in the league last year. And if you don't think that that's influential on this team's decision to start acting like this a little bit more this year, you're wrong. I mean, how do you not watch the Ravens befuddle the league and do so well defensively, you know, dialing up all these cover zeros all the time? You saw it on Monday night, and not think that that's something that you should be doing more of as part of your arsenal with that aggression in order to win this division. And we'll see if it plays out. We'll see how many times it does. You know, when you dial up the cover zero and you get the sack, or you get the off rhythm throw that falls incomplete, everybody praises the blitz. Blitz more, be more aggressive. Well, the moment Adam Thielen's running free, what are you doing? You know, I mean, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't in some ways.
And the thing here was, it wasn't just like Lou dialed up that zero blitz and that was the only kind of aggression we saw. He was a lot more aggressive throughout that game. And even with getting the push that they got that you wrote about from inside the defensive tackles and getting the pressure off the edge with Trey Hendrickson getting five pressures, he still dialed up a number of blitzes. And it wasn't just all out over and over again because it didn't need to be. But that was one of the big questions coming into the year, is would he be more aggressive with more players to deal with, more versatility on that defense? And they did. They really kept Kirk Cousins on his back foot. And yeah, you're going to look, they're not all going to work. And that one did not. It burned him for a touchdown, and it really changed the momentum of the game. But again, it's just like the fourth down decision that doesn't work. Sometimes you got to live with those.
They're certainly living with the fourth and inches throw down the field. Sure. You know, I mean, and so yeah, it comes and goes. The other thing I want to talk about, and again, there's a story up kind of detailing a lot of this on the site, athletic.com. We still have, we're limited time. It's not going to be much longer. We've got our 50% off promotional deal going on. So go, you can click on the links there at that story. It's out on Twitter, on the defensive line and the defensive tackles. And so we were talking a little bit about it in the walkout. But man, it has to equal some of last year's total season from the defensive tackles. And so we went through it. And if you just chart what PFF had over the course of all last season, anybody with a defensive tackle connected to their name, they totaled over the course of the entire season. There were 8 of them. They totaled over the course of the entire season, 3 sacks and 34 pressures. Well, on Sunday, anybody with a defensive tackle connected to their name totaled 3 sacks and 7 pressures. And that is not even half of it, when you consider that they also drew 5 holding calls, a 6th was declined. I mean, it was the absolute opposite end of the spectrum for what they were last year. They were the worst in the league at getting pressure up the middle last year, and yesterday they were arguably the best. B.J. Hill, Larry Ogunjobi, D.J. Reader, Josh Tupou, all of them were able to push up the pocket up into Kirk Cousins' face. And that's not even counting all the times he just was forced to back up and throw off his back foot and it goes out of bounds or drops incomplete or has to roll out. I mean, where some of those maybe even don't count as pressures. I mean, Larry Ogunjobi sacked Kirk Cousins with the body of Garrett Bradbury at one point. I mean, it was just all of those things you've seen Geno Atkins do over the years has ruined games, coming from a multitude of guys, and it made all the difference, in the world.
You mentioned Geno, and that's great point, because it's the classic case of don't know what you got until it's gone. And maybe that's not entirely accurate, because everyone knew Geno was special, but you almost took it for granted at times after, you know, as he got later in his career when he was still really dominant. And then all of a sudden that goes away and you're like, geez, this is 2020. There was just nothing at all. And really, they had the fourth sack too that was negated by the Eli Apple penalty. It was one of the most impressive performances I've seen from a Bengals D line in a long time. And the other thing, a hat tip to the fans. I thought it was just kind of trying to sell tickets and kind of just, you know, typical coach speak when Zach was, you know, begging for the jungle to be full and loud and everything leading up to that game, that it was a real difference maker. It wasn't just the five hold, all those false starts. And I went back and watched the part of the first part of the game, the TV copy, and this isn't just players saying, yeah, it was great, it was loud, we thank the fans. There was a point in the game where they did a sideline hit with Jen Hale, and as she's finishing up her hit, the play is starting and they kick it back upstairs, and Chris Myers, the play-by-play guy, is like, I'm sorry, Jen, we couldn't even hear the end of your report there. That's how loud it was in that stadium. And it wasn't full. Was it 54,000? And they can get 56 and they can get 65 in there. It can get louder. The fans, as great as the defensive line was, I do think that the fans get a nice little assist there, because even us, when you're in the press box, and I mentioned this in the walkout, you don't get a full appreciation of how loud it is. And then you go back and watch it on TV and listen to what the players are saying. And it really did go hand in hand to help that defensive line.
I mean, home field advantage is back in the league. I mean, last year we saw a lot of teams. There was different reasons why home field advantage existed last year, because traveling was a pain in the butt last year for everybody. But you know, this year that version of it, and we're going to see it all across the league. Certainly not just in Cincinnati. But the other part of the thing is, you know, last year the Bengals drew 15 holding penalties all year. So 3 sacks and 15 holding penalties drawn all last year. They had 3 sacks and 5 holding penalties and 1 declined in the first game. Now you would say, yeah, well, Minnesota's a train wreck, right? Like they had problems all up and down. But guess who else does? The next 3 opponents. Yeah. Chicago is worse than Minnesota up front, and they have injuries on top of it from week 1. 2 tackles ago. I mean, Jason Peters, anybody that watched what Carl Lawson did to Jason Peters last year knows how accessible that is. And he gets hurt, and you're bringing another backup, and they are banged up and already not very good. And this is going to be even, you know, they should be licking their chops even more. Same thing with Pittsburgh. That's how, if you're going to find a way to access Pittsburgh, who actually, showed fairly well considering the no names and all the change they've had up front, but that's the way to do it. Jacksonville, what a mess they are up front too, with particularly on the interior for them. So it's right there for the taking for these guys to really be the storyline of owning the first month. And I think the pressures record that we just talked about, pressures compared to last year, maybe holding penalties compared to last year, could be gone by the time you complete this 4-game stretch, if all continues to go to plan and it goes well. And you look at the snap counts, the 4 defensive tackles between 71 and 29%. It was those waves. Mm-hmm. It was bringing them through, keeping them fresh. You know, I'd argue early in last season, they put too much on DJ Reader. They tried to turn him into this 3-down guy who's playing a little bit too much. And he still played a lot, but, you know, keep him a little bit fresher and the ability that you can do that. And I think you'll see Hill and Tupou snaps maybe even come up a little more now after the way they played. I think that combination can really be deadly when you have that kind of freshness coming in, particularly early in the season.
I like how Lou Anarumo immediately reverted to preseason Lou, where he's not going to praise anybody. I mean, he praised the group as a whole, but I asked him about Josh Tupou. He's like, yeah, well, he had a running back trying to block him. Anybody should win that one-on-one. But I was really impressed with Tupou. He's always been that run plugger, and if you're getting pressures up the middle from that guy, it's going to be really interesting to watch over these next 3 weeks, because think about it, 3 sacks this game. If they just do that over the next 3 games, that gets them to 12 for the year. They had 17 all of last year, and they were next to last in the league in pressures. They can really take a huge step through this first quarter of the season. And if they do that, you're talking about everything we talked about leading up to the season, where a young team finds success early and the confidence really explodes and things start to snowball, and it can lead to a much different looking 2021 than everyone was betting on when the season started.
Just remember, it's not about, and it's really not as much about sacks when you look at the big picture. It's about those times when the center is all of a sudden in the quarterback's face. It's about disruptions. It's about holding calls. It's about all those things, and that is where the defensive tackles made it. And really, Trey Hendrickson had a bizarro Trey Hendrickson game, where last year, right, the argument was, I don't know if he's one of those top free agent edge rushers. How much of it was his sacks were really set up by everybody else? He didn't have any sacks, but his pressures, he got 2 holding calls. He led the team in pressures with 5. I mean, he was really disruptive off the edge, even though he never got one of those sacks. The other people got the sacks, but him coming off the edge really did make a big difference. So I thought, you know, you kind of did get what you wanted from Trey Hendrickson, even though he didn't give you what the selling point was from him in free agency, gave you the disruption. All right, it's time for our new segment with Mo Egger. So let's jump in. Jamar Chase is going to be our topic. You know, Mo, we just don't spend enough time together on Tuesdays. Already the Tuesday hour in studio, that's our regular standing appointment at 3 o'clock on ESPN 1530. We're adding 10 more of those here on Hear That Podcast Ground for those people who are averse to radio, I guess, which they shouldn't be.
They shouldn't be, but very few people in my life who spend a prolonged amount of time with me actually want to extend it. So yeah. You're the exception. Usually people are looking to shorten the amount of time they spend with me.
Yeah, it's because it's just that much fun. So, you know, that segment is that hour that we do in studio there is, we've titled it something really, we hate the fact, one, that's always named after, like somebody has to do a play on a name, and you get that. I mean, how many versions of something, Mo, that you've had to do over the years, I just feel for you, right? I wasn't going to make this 10 Mo minutes. I just can't do that to you.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. As somebody whose show has no official name, I appreciate the unwillingness at times to name stuff because I don't really see the point.
Well, the name that I have for this, and it'll be a working title, is 10 minutes of a delightful, potentially informative and potentially humorous conversation with ESPN 1530's Mo Egger about a topic regarding the Cincinnati Bengals or another tangentially related development. Sound good?
Are you going to get like a voice guy?
Can I use your voice guy? Can we use the same voice person from
Stephanie? Yeah, we can get Stephanie to voice that for you.
All right, we'll do that. We'll keep working this. We'll try to keep improving it, but maybe as the year goes along. Today's topic will be Jamar Chase, one that we have not spent much time talking about over the course of the offseason, and nobody really has any opinions on. I'll start with this, Mo. We talked a lot over the course of the previous couple months about how you would feel when that first ball was in the air headed to Jamar Chase against Minnesota. How did you feel when that first ball was in the air on his way to Jamar Chase against Minnesota?
I said out loud, oh boy. You know, I mean, I said that out loud, but you know, the thing is, his first touch wasn't a pass. It was a handoff, and it just kind of happened. And then once it did, I sort of thought, like, all right, that's how you do it. That's how you do it, right? Get him the ball. The play didn't gain anything. It didn't go anywhere. But get him the ball. He hangs on to it. He gets hit. And, all right, Jamar, welcome to the NFL. Now can you help the team? And he did. But, yeah, when that first pass was in the air, I went, oh, boy. And then he caught the pass. And it was a nice catch. And it was, I thought, a perfectly thrown ball. And it was like, all right, great. Let's go. And he did, which was awesome. And I was thrilled for the Bengals. I was really happy for Jamar Chase, particularly with all the crap that he took at the end of last week. I was really, really happy that he had one of the best rookie debuts in the history of the franchise.
I was wondering, because your freeze frame moment with the Saved by the Bell, you know, that was a rope. There was time to say, oh boy, what were you thinking on the deep ball? And I do think that was great that it was a deep out, his first touch. It wasn't an easy screen like in the Miami game where you kind of get in your own head. He had to really go get that ball, not think about it, just get it. The 50-yard bomb was a little different. It's hanging up there forever. Did you, in your mind, freeze frame it? And what were your thoughts if you did?
My thoughts were the Cincinnati Bengals are being aggressive at the end of the first half and nothing else matters. It didn't matter who the ball was going to. I just love the fact, excuse me, I just love the fact that they, and you know, Zach Taylor's decision-making became a talking point all afternoon. But I mean, I love the fact that they didn't run a handoff or two and go to the locker room and settle for being tied. I love the fact that they were aggressive. And so I was more into, holy crap, they're going to try to score a touchdown here in the waning moments of a half. What bizarre world are we in? What are we doing here? The fact that it went to Jamar Chase was just, for me, icing on the cake. But in the aftermath of that, I thought often about how, okay, if that's a part of this arsenal week one, oh boy, what's the ceiling for this unit? And that to me was really what I walked away from the entire game thinking about, because you could talk about Sunday and spend a lot of time on what they did and I guess to a degree didn't do offensively. And there was so much there, but the headliner was that play to Jamar Chase, which is what we spend all of the run up to the draft talking about. If you were Team Chase, as I was, the selling point was they're going to have an amount of explosiveness that they lacked last year. They're going to be able to throw the ball deep and to not just do it on some random 3rd and 12, but to do it in a situation in which Bengals fans are conditioned to expect either nothing to happen or something bad to happen. For that play to go down when it did, it was the perfect storm of awesomeness. And at that point, I really wasn't thinking about, is he going to catch it? Is he not going to catch it? Those are high degree of difficulty catches. I'm more into, is he going to catch the easy stuff? There are going to be streak routes that he runs where the play gets broken up or Joe misses the pass or even Jamar drops it. Those are high degree of difficulty catches. I'm not going to crush him for dropping those. I'll hammer him for dropping the one like the play against Miami in the last preseason game, or even some of the shorter passes that he caught on Sunday. But more than anything, I was just, oh, if this is how we're going to play the end of the first half, and if this is how they can play the end of the first half, this is going to be a lot of fun. And Sunday was a hell of a lot of fun.
That moment, I thought the euphoric release from the crowd when that happens of, you know, was only made greater by the run up of wondering how long it's going to take Jamar Chase to be that guy, and for it to happen on the first game and in that position at the end of the half, and for it to look so similarly to the national championship highlight that everyone's been watching since before he was drafted here to the Bengals, makes it even all that much more special. I mean, being out there, how did that compare with some of the other big moments you've even experienced being out in the stands?
It was, with maybe the exception of Von Bell knocking down Juju Smith-Schuster last year, it was the best Paul Brown Stadium moment, certainly since Zach Taylor's been the head coach. And I mean, it was, I think people just sort of looked at each other like, what's going on here? I mean, again, we're conditioned to expect the Bengals to screw it up right before half, fair or not. And that's probably to a degree not fair to this particular head coach, but yeah, I mean, it sort of was like, all right, they have a bona fide chance to win this football game after really sort of playing like a turtle with its head in the shell for the first quarter. They were really conservative, really kind of boring. In fact, my buddy remarked to me, he's like, I think the first quarter is Joe Burrow's preseason game. It felt that way, right? It was really vanilla, really conservative. And then for them to open things up, the defense had been playing really well to that point, to go in with a lead, go in with aggressiveness. And I mean, I just, you know, I always get together with people at halftime and it's like, well, that's not what I was expecting, both in terms of the play and the aggressiveness and the score. It was cool, but I just felt really happy for Ja'Marr Chase more than anything else, because it could not have been easy to go through these last couple of weeks with everybody wondering, can he catch a pass? Did the Bengals get it wrong in the draft? The whole small ball, white stripes thing that was just so dramatically overblown. And you guys pointed that out. There's always a big spotlight on a guy like Ja'Marr, who's, you know, fifth overall pick and being counted on to do so much for this team offensively. But then you add all these other narratives to it for him to smash them. And it doesn't mean he's not going to drop passes. It doesn't mean that he's going to have a successful NFL career, but for him to have that rookie debut in the context of everything that's been talked about over the last couple of weeks, I just was really thrilled for him. I was really, really happy for him as a guy. And hopefully I feel that way often this year.
All right, let's just take a quick break.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm glad we have you here and we're on this subject of live reaction, you being in the stands, because I don't want to say fans lie, but they twist things. And I really want to know, because after the fact, anytime there's a controversial coaching decision, there's always the armchair quarterbacking. And the fourth and one at their own 30, what was the reaction in the stands when Zach sent the team out? Was everybody like, yeah, we're going for it? Or was everybody like, what are we doing?
Yes. And myself included. And I've walked it back a little bit. But yeah, there was a sense of, this is going really well. Your defensive line is playing great. You're up by a couple of scores. You have a good punter. Let's not get too cute here. Let's kick it away, play defense. And if they score, you're up a touchdown and let's go. Mm. There was a sense of, this is a little bit too aggressive. And I don't like tweeting during Bengals games. I especially don't like tweeting at Paul Brown Stadium. But I tweeted something to the effect of, like, what are we doing here? But I was thinking about it after the game, and I'm like, all right, I'm the guy who's usually crushing coaches for not being aggressive. When they hired Zach Taylor, that's what I wanted. I wanted the guy – who's gonna be aggressive. He's gonna, you know, be aggressive at the end of the first half. He's gonna, you know, sort of set the tone with his team, aggressiveness in play calling, aggressiveness in decision making. His first game ever against Seattle, they lost that game. But what did we walk away from it? We walked away from it talking about, well, this isn't like Marvin Lewis. This is different. This is aggressive. If you're going to do that, if you want the aggressive guy, and there were times that Zach was really conservative, the third and four late in the game when they ran the football. But if you're gonna want the guy to be aggressive, I think you have to be willing to take some stuff that you're not necessarily gonna like. It's not the best comparison, but if you're gonna have your quarterback throw the ball deep a lot, well, that's gonna come at the expense of completion percentage. It's probably gonna come at the expense of more interceptions, throws that aren't safe. But you want him to take risks. You want him to try to beat teams downfield. You want large chunk plays. You have to understand there's gonna be something that comes with that. And so if I'm gonna yell and scream that Zach should be aggressive and let's have some big ones when we make our decisions, sometimes that's maybe going to cross over into being a little bit too greedy, or some, one might say being stupid. I can live with that if the tone for the final 16 games is we're going to do some aggressive stuff in an effort to go ahead and win the game and not be passive. And I've tried to frame it like that in the aftermath of the game. Admittedly, had they lost that game, there's a really good chance I wouldn't have felt that way. But if you're going to ask a coach to be aggressive, there are going to be moments in which he's maybe a little bit too aggressive for his own good. But in the moment, at least where I sit, there was an ace. I sat right behind two Minnesota Vikings fans, and the guy turned to me. We were calling him Tiny Soda for some reason. I don't know what the origin of that was, but I said, "Hey, Tiny Soda, welcome back to the game," or something to that effect, probably much more vulgar. And he's like, I don't know what your coach is doing. I mean, you've gotten his beat. I don't know what your guy is doing. And then they scored the touchdown and he had a good laugh and I wasn't very happy, but no, in the stands, nobody liked that, but I've reconciled myself with it to a degree in the aftermath of the game.
Yeah. There's only really one major takeaway that I came away from this game with that I think is the most important, and that is that the preseason doesn't matter and that all reporters and media should just get the month of August off. There's no reason for us to be breaking down anything that's happening because, you know, Jamar Chase goes through and all the hubbub that's created. And then with one deep ball, we all realize we really should have just taken a vacation last month. Like, I really should have just gone ahead and gone to, you know, the beach and relax for a little while rather than those Chase takes.
What would sports talk radio do, though, without Chase takes? I mean, you know,
talk about baseball.
I'd love to. I mean, be fun if somebody would actually try to win the National League wild card. But I mean, you know, as much as Jamar Chase couldn't catch a pass in the preseason, that fell into my hands, like, you know, like the pass that he dropped against Miami. It was wonderful to talk about. And look, I think it was fair to talk about, okay, game one against Minnesota, ball comes his way. How do you feel? How's Joe Burrow going to feel? What's his role going to be in the offense? Well, we answered all those questions on Sunday, but the degree to which people took it, even before the whole striped ball thing, it's a byproduct of the times we live in. It's a byproduct of certainly me, the industry that I work in. And that's part of it that I really don't like. I felt for the dude. I felt for the guy. I mean, it's hard enough to play in the NFL. It's harder to play as a rookie. It's really hard to play in your first game and have so much expected of you. And then you add to it all this other stuff, much of which is your own fault, because if you would have caught all those passes in the preseason, nobody would be doing this. But for all of that to be swirling around him and the team, for him to not just go out there and catch three passes for 23 yards, but for him to have the impact that he did, again, in the history of the franchise, ain't a whole lot of guys whose rookie debuts were that good. And by the way, we could say the same about my guy, Evan McPherson. I don't know, man. You guys root for people and root for stories. I've put myself in that sort of frame of mind. I'm just really happy for the guy to do what he did in the environment that he did and help the team win a game in the aftermath of everything that kind of swirled last week.
I always root for people to stick it to the internet. And Jamar Chase and Joe Burrow stuck it to the internet. And that's really, it's really the core of any rooting interest that I have at this point, is for people that try to shame and do all that stuff on the internet end up in sports can end up having flipped on their face so quickly. And
right.
That was gratifying. Mo, thank you for this first edition of 10 Minutes of Delightful, potentially informative, and potentially humorous conversation with ESPN 53's Mo Egger on a topic regarding the Cincinnati Bengals or another tangentially related development. We do need to get that voice. I can't say it very often.
I will talk to you both this week.
Talk to you later.
Thanks, Mo.
All right. Always great to hear from Mo, and we'll hear from Mo every single Tuesday here as we drop in a different topic. And of course, you can hear Mo and I for even more time, an hour, 3 to 4 o'clock on ESPN 1530 every Tuesday as well. Jay's got stats. They're not sad at all. They're actually quite optimistic. What are your Jamar Chase stats?
Yeah, I just expanded on what we already hit on leading up to this game. The Bengals record for most receiving yards in an NFL debut was 82 by Jordan Shipley, and Jamar almost had that beat by halftime. I think he had 80 at halftime. And then obviously the next step was to look at the NFL record, and it was, okay, Anquan Boldin, 217 yards. No one expects anyone to beat that. I don't know how that's going to ever go down. But I thought, you know, Jamar goes over 100. So I was like, well, I wonder how many guys actually went over 100 yards in their debut. And it was 19, and now it's 20. And this is since the 1970 merger, 52 seasons, only 19 guys had done it. And Jamar pulled it out. And there's some names on that list. Really, there's two from 1982, which was the strike year. So they were scab players. So really, you're talking about 17 guys that did it against true NFL defenses. There's the concerning, that's impressive to do something that only 17 other guys did. The concerning thing here is there's some names on here that, you know, maybe a lot of people haven't heard of, and there's not a lot of names of Hall of Fame type guys on here, but it's Anquan Boldin at the top. It's Lewis Lips, Marquise Brown for the Ravens, who had a touchdown last night in that Monday, that crazy Monday night game. Eddie Royal, TJ Hockenson, and Terry McLaurin, both recently in 2019. And then you get down to Will Fuller, DeSean Jackson. There's some guys that have had some really good careers that did this, that started off topped 100 right off the bat. And we were talking so much about how many drops Jamar would have in the opener, and it turned up that turned out being the conversation was how many yards would he have?
Yeah, I mean, it's better than the opposite. You know, yeah. I don't think it's a determining factor, but it's better than the opposite. And he gave the team exactly what they were looking for this entire offseason, was that explosion over the top, and it ended up, you know, you can argue it was the difference in the game, getting that play before halftime. Let's here's the other thing. We got to talk about the offensive line. And, you know, Joe Burrow got hit a bunch. I mean, go back and look at his first touchdown pass to T. Higgins. He gets squared up under his chin. He does a great job holding the ball to the last second while takes time to break that open behind the safety. And takes one right under the chin and gets pounded. You know, he takes 5 sacks. He gets rolled up on. He has to hobble off and get on the bike, and he's kind of grabbing at his shoulder. And I mean, you know, for a guy in his first game back, and everyone was nervous. I mean, that was some nerve wracking stuff. What happened there, right? Whose fault was it? Well, some encouraging stuff when you really break it down. PFF does, looking specifically, Riley Reiff and Jonah Williams in 31 pass blocking snaps did not allow pressure. So if you're putting it on people, it didn't end up on those guys. And I think that's what we anticipated, was those. That was your most solid part. You love your bookends there. It was going to be the interior you were concerned about, and that was where a lot of the issues came from. The Bengals put 2 sacks on, I believe that's what Zach said, 2 sacks on the offensive line. And one was obviously on Trey Hopkins, who got beat hard by Michael Pierce a couple of times. And then Xavier Suafilo also had his hand in another one. Drew Sample, you know, trying to block Neil Hunter. It ain't that ain't it, right? Like that's that he's not going to win that all the time. And you and a running back, Samaje Perine with a whiff, you know, you get caught outside of the numbers. They've got to protect him a little bit with play calls, and you've got to hope that you can see a little bit better. You know, Hopkins in his first game coming off ACL, I just think it was a little bit of an acclimation period for him.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I mentioned Eli Apple earlier being the lowest scoring or lowest graded guy PFF. Trey Hopkins was the lowest scoring, the lowest graded guy by PFF on the offensive side, and then Perine was second, and Suofilo was fourth, and that's because of the pressures they gave up. And Lou Anarumo said it too. They gave up five sacks. He said only two of those were on the line. Three were on the rest of the crew. It wasn't ideal. If Joe Burrow gets sacked five times every game, he may not play every game, but it's still to have the bookends hold up the way they did against a good Minnesota defense, against a Mike Zimmer defense that finds a way to get to guys, that should be the encouraging part. And I do think Trey will come around. It's kind of like in baseball when you say you look at the back of the baseball card. He doesn't have a history of grading that low. I think it was an acclimation period. He'll be fine. The question is going to be what we said it was going to be all year. How are those guards going to hold up? How are they going to keep pressure out of Joe's face?
And, you know, they held up enough that they were able to put 27 points up against the Vikings, and that's something. And it's not going to be that tough every week. I mean, there's obviously it's the NFL. It's going to come through, and they've got to be better. The other side is, you know, I think they did what they realized they needed to do. Like, look, Burrow's getting beat up, dropping back as hell on wheels right now. Run the ball. And Joe Mixon ends up 4.4 yards per carry. Man, if – I don't anticipate him having 29 attempts and 33 touches every week. I mean, that's a lot. But I think the fact that they said Burrow gives us the lead, Mixon finishes him off as a strategy, and you end up running it a whole lot more than you passed it. You know, we mentioned after the game in the walkout, career low of attempts for Joe, but career high in completion percentage and yards per attempt and all the efficiency stats. It's ideal, man. And you're gonna, if that's the way games go, you're gonna win way more than you lose, and you're not gonna need last second crazy fumbles to do it. I mean, Joe Mixon had some great runs trying to finish that game off. Great runs, and did seem to get better as the game went along and found his rhythm and found a rhythm with the line. And I thought that was the encouraging aspect of it was how consistent he was. This wasn't Mixon trying to bounce everything. This wasn't Mixon getting caught in the backfield. If somebody was in the backfield, he could make a miss. The lack of negative runs. No real negative runs outside of the Jamar Chase jet sweep. I mean, Mixon got what he had to get. He turned negative one into two. He turned, you know, two into five a lot. And then at the end had some really nice runs to finish it off. It would have been fitting if he on third and four would have found a way to break through and get that first down on third down, because it felt like he had that finishing mentality to him. That's how he ended up at 4.4 per carry.
Yeah, and I mean, that's ideally, you're right. That is how you want it to look, with Burrow getting him the lead and then Mixon finishing it off. You're not always going to be playing 70 minutes of football. You're not always going to be playing in 87 degree heat or whatever it was at the end of that game. I think that kind of played into the decision there too, but I don't want to say it's a template, but it is something that they want to happen. The other thing here is, what did they say about Chris Evans in the preseason? Is that he can't do what he did in college. You just got to hit the hole and go. And sometimes 0, 1, 2 yards is a good play. And he saw that live out in person with Joe Mixon, because he wasn't trying to shake everybody. He was just hitting the hole and getting what he could. And they were grinding it out and running the clock. And it was. I picked Mixon as my breakout player of the year, and I don't think that was a breakout game. That was kind of a vintage Joe Mixon game. I still think there's a lot more there. I do think we're going to see him break some runs, and this offensive line only get better. Mixon's relationship and meshing with them only getting better. And there were so many plays that he looked dead, you know, out on the edge or even in the backfield, and he he just ran through tackles. And there was one play, and I remember he broke two tackles and had the presence of mind to slide down inbounds late in that game when they were trying to grind the clock out before Minnesota tied it. Just a really underrated part of that whole game. Lost in the Burrow comeback, lost in the fourth down decisions, the defense. Joe Mixon was as big a part of that win as anybody.
Yeah, I mean, the ability to run all of that clock. I mean, we talk about the decision at the very end, but I mean, to run it down once they got the stop, in a big part thanks to the hold on Ogunjobi there that forced Vikings to punt with like six and some change left. I mean, they run it all the way down where the Vikings are getting the ball at with a 1:48 left at their own five because of Joe Mixon. Mm-hmm. And that's how you finish games, and they just didn't quite get that last finish. But, you know, that was really the most encouraging part offensively, because it's how you keep the pressure off of Burrow. I mean, it's how you keep him from taking so many hits. If you can really, if you can keep that balance, and that's what went wrong last year so often, early in the season in particular, you just were constantly having to throw it so many times, 40, 50 times. I mean, Cleveland 60 times. Like, you just can't be that. And that, I think, is an encouraging way that this went, where they're staying in front of the sticks. They're not getting themselves in too many third and longs, and feeling comfortable having drives where the vast majority of it is just turning around and handing it off. That's good for Joe Burrow, and it's great for what this offense can be. It's the difference between good and being a nightmare for defensive coordinators. All right, that'll wrap us up. Of course, we'll be back on Thursday. We'll have our Bears preview. We'll talk to our folks in Chicago, which is always fun. And by that point, I'll have all my dinner reservations and show reservations already plotted out for my big weekend in Chicago. You're right, Jay. It's just a great place. Just a great place. Lou Malnati's, I'm coming for you. Okay. I'm on the way. I'm guessing some of you might be making the trip as well. If you are, we'll make sure we get some of those recommendations out there for you, as we talk to our local folks on the ground in Chicago. But anyway, thanks everybody for listening to Hear That Podcast Growling, and we'll talk to you on Thursday. Have a good one, everybody.